Well, so they will talk about the course distributions first and then...
Okay.
So I guess...
Let me have a proposition. So, so one piece of what I might say about force distributions would relate to something I didn't show last time, which is 5 minutes worth, I think.
Good.
So how about if I do that and then come back in this context, and also there's it was a companion paper to this work that appeared in Nature by the Chicago group. And it might be worth looking at what they had, because on the surface of
Okay, great.
So, try to contrast them because they don't look at all alike.
I think it'd be worth to go over the new information, because we can, all those of us who are really focused on force distribution, can discuss those maybe.
Okay. So let's just move to another one.
That's a fast talk.
Okay, so this is actually experiments that were done by Karen Daniels. And the context here was a 3D shear experiment. So what you're looking at here is, this is a vertical cut through something with axial symmetry. So there's an angular region where the real spheres, which are fairly close to the amount of dispersed, and they are being sheared by a rough surface up here, which is, so it has roughness which is not periodic, so random surface bumps, and then it's being taken from underneath. And at the same time, then we measure, so the shaker actually provides some additional static loading, and we measure the pressure over some region which is roughly a square centimeter at the bottom of something which is 3 or 4 centimeters across.
Okay, the rough surfaces is not the way you described it before on the, say, the inner or the outer cylinder of the coaxial.
In the 2D experiments? Yeah, so this is particles stuck down randomly on this surface.
On that surface.
Okay. That's
the surface that's...
That's the surface that shears.
And the sidewalls are smooth?
The sidewalls are smooth, and you can look through them. And that effect, so you're looking through in these little cuts, right? So you look through some, you look through the whole sidewall, but of course we can see some window.
So in that picture of understanding the orientation, you actually see the bottom one is like a grain boundary between the two crystal orientations?
No, this system is and may have local regions of order, but overall it's a disordered system.
You have to explain that picture to us, because the picture's on the...
So these are two different states that these are characteristic of two different states that we see. One of which is ordered, okay, 3D. So if you pull the system apart and look inside, it's crystallized.
What am I seeing that these sort of hard triangles?
The question is whether you see that from the side. You see that from the right.
From the side. From the into the side here. The stripes are because we build up the wall of a stacked ring of plexiglass things. So ignore that. These stripes are just an artifact.
It's the interface.
Yeah, right. So they're not. Don't look at the stripes. Look at where the particles are. Yeah.
They're spherical particles?
And the spherical particles, right. At least they start out that way. Okay, so you get two different states here, and I'll tell you how you get them, but let me show you what they look like first. Okay, so now it's being vibrated. Okay, so it's being vibrated here. These are relatively high speed videos, okay? You can see the particles are being sheared from the top.
So the only lateral force is at the top, is that right?
The only lateral force, right.
It's to the left?
To the left, absolutely. And so the whole thing, of course, is being dragged along.
You've sliced off, it looks like you've tried to make a combination of three different pictures that you've sort of sliced off.
Yeah, I mean, this is a freshman physics optics you're looking through. Stacks of material with the boundary, which would get some, a little bit of scattering of light in the boundary. So now I
So do you extract strain or displacement versus vertical position?
I don't know that I have that. I mean, I have a very strong fear that I probably don't have that in these slots that I can share with you. Okay, and now this guy is the disordered state. And again, it's being vibrated, and this system has to actually dilate a fair amount. And if you then look at some measure of, you know, if you look at the GORs and that, the system is disordered.
It doesn't seem to be moving quite as rapidly along the base as the previous one.
Well, I mean, you know, these, you have to remember this, you know, the video rate may be different, or they just be at a slower shaking speed. So.
I mean, it's clearly not perfectly ordered, but G of R, I mean, G of R could miss polycrystalline information, and it does look like there's
You can get some local order.
Which would vary a lot as a function of height.
It doesn't vary as much as you want, but it does vary some. So I think that's either that. Not sure. All right. So hopefully maybe I'll have the structural information somewhere. And at any rate, you can simply look at the density of the system in pattern fraction. As a function of shear rate, then what you find is the system solidifies into a crystal at low shearing, and then as you get shear melts, then you get a higher shear. And that's a hysteretic transition, so that once you have disordered, then you come back down.
What happens to the torque when it shear melts?
No idea. Sorry.
What was that question?
Well, it turns out that if you look at colloidal crystals, when they undergo the transition from a shearing solid phase to a fluid phase, the stress actually rises.
Because
it's harder to shear the fluid than solid.
Interesting.
So shear...
It's counterintuitive.
Shear strengthening?
You get shear strengthening associated with melting.
Well, in some sense, this system is strengthening. But it's not clear. So what's happening? Okay, if you look at the packing fraction, it steadily is growing as you shear it faster and faster. Okay, so it's actually pushing against the load, and so it does get stronger in that sense.
Well, so that's a normal stress with this linear in shear rate, which is also what we've seen in the simulations of the.
No, it's longer. It's longer.
Oh, sorry. Forget it.
Okay.
This
we can't do.
But so this is the same logarithmic strengthening that you see in the 2D shapes, right? So qualitative.
What's the right hand axis?
The right hand axis is the high hand. Okay, so
it's
getting denser, is it?
No,
it's getting less dense.
It's getting less dense.
Oh, I see, because
it's getting dense.
But that's the packing fractions changing logarithmically.
Right, so it's dilating.
The normal stress is constant. And so the experiments on the colloids are done at constant packing fraction, measuring the change in normal load. It's hard to compare the two.
Right.
Because you need to know how the normal load depends upon packing fraction.
I have one following question on the way you described this. We see red is increasing.
Red is crystallized.
No, red solid crystallized. But red in general is increasing. Blue is decreasing, or black is decreasing.
Okay, yeah.
And so we're seeing. Did you describe this as a hysteretic?
Type
effect? Because then it does suddenly jump back to an order.
Yeah, no, it's hysteretic. So you jump back to the lower shear rate.
And one common assemblage you can do this. Experiment. You can use one assemblage of particles and just progressively increase the rate and then decrease the rate.
Yeah, and this is all the fixed number of particles. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've just been down at Irvine, I was visiting Mike Dennett, and he was showing me some of his programmatic experiments. And I think he said that he was seeing some important effect of the walls on whether he saw like a band deformation or like a homogeneous shear across them. I was wondering. How do you control for the effect of the container?
Okay, so his, when you say his continuing walls, that means his, the surface which is shearing or a surface which maybe is.
So it's a different, right? Like the foam, I think, was maybe could be contained between two plates, and then shear could be applied, or you take off the plate, and just, and so in the case where there was a plate on top, you saw very localized shearing near the sliding surface.
Right.
In the case where he removed the top plate, he saw like a uniform distribution of shear.
But that's a drag effect.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, why wouldn't you have drag effects in a cell of this?
But you do have some, right? I mean, it's a smooth, the idea is you make those boundaries as smooth as you can, so that effect is minimal. And you can't get rid of them, so there's no equivalent to taking off the top. But I think that is, you know, the friction with the walls is relatively new. But
gamma is the vibration rate, that's what's plotted on the lower axis.
No, that's a shear rate. It's a shear rate.
Why isn't it hertz?
How fast you're right.
Okay.
It's a period of rotation errors.
So what's gamma?
Gamma is the acceleration.
What?
But gamma is the shape.
Your peak acceleration is 2g.
Okay, so that's held constant, but the shear rate, which is given by omega, right there.
Okay.
And the frequency?
So, frequency is 65.
So, this is showing the packing fraction versus shear. Have you looked at the width of the shearing region as a function of shear rate?
It did. And I don't have that right here. I have to dig that out, but I can show that to you later if you want. So it does
tend to thicken the shearing layer.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, all right, so here is a measure of. So these are spatial autocorrelation analysis. And when you're in the crystalline regime, what you tend to get is something like these guys. And then when you move into the fluid-like phase, right, you get in-plane ordering, which is sort of like the stuff that Golub and Sala have seen, right? And I don't know if you guys are you guys familiar with that? Okay, so a set of experiments which were done by Jerry Golub and Jason Tsai. And in those experiments, they had a somewhat similar experiment to this, except there was no vibration, and it was fluid filled, so they could visualize what's going on. And so then what they found is if they waited a long, long time, then there was invariably a transition to an in-plane ordered state. So they had layers, hexagonal layers, which were sloughing across other hexagonal layers. Okay. So yeah, which I think is something people see in college as well.
Yeah, we certainly saw it in the simulations. You get similar sort of structure in the limb of one scattering functions.
So
liquid crystals.
Right. Except that I mean, it still has a finite range, so it's not like so in the Golub Tsai experiments. Really, there was correlation essentially on the scale of the experiment.
Sure. What does a flow look like if you look down from the top? I mean, is it like a plug and it's flowing fast in between two walls, or
in the crystalline phase? You know?
In either.
Okay. So we can't really look, by the way, down from the top or into the center, except by pulling the system apart when it's done. So we know that when we pull it apart, have pulled it apart, it appears crystalline all the way through. So therefore, it tends to flow more or less as a plug. And if you look at the movie in the crystalline phase, you can see that plug slipping across the bottom. And then there was a very, very narrow one particle wide shear zone at the top. But other than that, you tend to have unblocked movement of the whole thing. On the other hand, you know, once you start talking about a disordered phase, then, well, it's much harder to say for us exactly what's going on in general. But you can see that if you do get these linear strands. So if you look here, I mean, you see regions which are crystalline orders, and therefore a little piece of crystalline order, and you see other things where it looks like you have lines which are slipping across. So you have competition between those two sorts of things. Alright, so now, this was sort of what I was leading up to. It was going to be. So if you look at now the force distributions as seen at the bottom of surface current, so, and now you look as a function of where you are in the space diagram, if you are in the crystalline phase, then you see things like this, okay? And keep in mind this is on a log length scale. So what these are is basically the PDF of what you would see if you had an oscillating wave sitting on a plate, right? So a PDF of a sine function is a Batman function, to say,
okay?
True? And then, and now, so the interesting thing is, if you move into the fluidized space, right, then you get these PDFs which actually look a lot like what we saw earlier when we just applied a load on the system and sheared it. But when you go close to the transition, then the tail stretches out way, way far.
Okay. How do you measure the force in this case?
It's a capacitive predicate. Okay, so it has, so it's a centimeter sized disk, yeah, and the particles are 2 or 3 millimeters. So you've got, so you've got 10 particles at a time.
And so you're averaging over
that range.
Would you remind me what kurtosis means?
Yeah, it's a
transformation.
Okay. It's a scale of fourth level. So it's a departure from the Gaussian. Okay. And so what's happening is you're skewing things way out of this. And that gets appears, for instance, most clearly in the kurtosis, which has this cusp-like structure which you're coming down again.
The dashed line there is just the guide of the eye.
That is a guide of the eye line.
That you're seeing.
Well, there's a point of it.
Okay. So.
Getting defensive. Okay. So there's an amusing singularity here. And by the way,
now this side of the room needs to understand.
Okay.
No,
I was just interrupting you on your behalf.
I'm sorry.
Did somebody interrupt her on my perfect, sorry. Okay.
I'm just confused by the omegas there. So it's non-monotonic, is it? The different currents?
Yeah, because it may be non-monotonic. The point is that this curve is sitting right near the transition point. So, let's see. Not sure we can.
Yeah, it's
okay.
It is non-monotonic.
But the point is that when you, okay, as you go into the transition region, you're
right,
stretching out. So it's not a monotonic thing.
And that's the point of it.
Yeah, the green is the.
And that is a little better.
Right. Okay.
And accompanied with these stretching out of the forces.
So do you know whether you're supposed to be in here or in the small seminar room?
There's a seminar in this small seminar room.
All right, I'm probably in the wrong place, so we hope.
Yeah,
we are.
Well, we were here. if you look at the volume of the fluctuations in the system, you see something comparable, right? So this is the kurtosis data, and then if you look at the volume fluctuations, they have the same kind of cusp. Okay, the volume fluctuations are the equivalent of a specific heat in an Edwards formalism. So this is said you have a specific heat anomaly at this transition point.
So that's in the point equilibrium. That's not a hysteresis in that plot.
It's steady state. You mean? I assume.
Yeah.
These are all steady states.
But if you have a hysteretic transition, then your transition would be at different points going up.
This is the data coming down. Yeah. So,
okay, so the data coming up would look slightly different?
They would be shifted.
Can you somehow independently check the compressibility, or?
Yes and no. Okay, so the one trick is you measure the pressure at the bottom. Okay. Yes, in principle, you use the compressibility. The amusing thing is what you measure at the bottom doesn't account for the full load on the system. So there is some stress transferal to the walls, which you can measure, okay? And it actually is a function of where you are in the
space. Can you tell us that if you could somehow change some other parameter, perhaps the density,
right,
you would actually be exactly at the critical point, you just
Well, it's
not a critical.
It's not critical.
It's not a first order.
Well, it's both first order and critical. Like it's bizarre. It's like I'm just like jamming. It has first order and critical like properties.
This defines a distinct phase transition. Is that how one answers this?
Yeah, it does. Well, yeah. I mean,
that's what I'm trying to probe.
Jim was asking this question yesterday.
And the question is, what kind of and what sense is the phase transition? Now I'm really confused.
Could it exist at both states at that point? Is that the
end? Oh, that's what he seems to be. He sees histories.
His histories.
So that makes him think that it's got some first order character.
That's right.
On the other hand, he's also seeing a divergence of some sort of.
I don't think it's really a divergence there.
It's singular, but not divergent. You can be singular,
but not divergent. Okay, in a mean field model, which doesn't get the correct.
Right.
It's singularity.
That's still singular.
It's not divergent, but it's.
Just continuous.
Something like this,
right?
And in most of those models, you can, first place, you can do your calculation better, especially if you know where the actual critical point is, like a zero magnetic field or something like that. But you can also, for other systems, dial some parameter that actually makes it a critical. The question is, does something like that happen?
Yeah, and I think the answer is you could argue that's partly true. I mean if you dial the density just right, and you're not in gravitational field, then you could clearly go for something that looks more like a critical jam.
So it looks as if it's a sort of weakly first order transition that's somehow just not too far from the curve.
To what extent would this curve be singular if you didn't see there was a jump? Because I doubt it is singular. I think it seems singular because the one phase becomes unstable, mm-hmm. and you jump into the other one.
Right.
But if you didn't see the curve, if you didn't see the discontinuity at this point two,
right.
you would have no means of saying that if you just see the one branch of the curve,
right.
things would be singular mm-hmm. at that point.
Okay, so you would say that it just would continue. Since for some reason, it's going up. Or it's going up,
but I don't really think you can argue. It might be nice to check things like, size behavior, size scaling, because mm-hmm. that's when you can get a guess whether you really have something that becomes singular.
Mm-hmm.
But just looking at that data,
uh-huh.
I wouldn't be convinced that that curve is singular at all.
Well, it's supposed that ideally it was just, those fluctuations are zero up to point two, and then this is finite discontinuity.
Well, but you only see the discontinuity because the one phase becomes.
And if this is the specific heat, then that's not a problem for a first order transition.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think it you could argue it's a first order transition with some fluctuations happening
right.
near the transition and,
right.
and
sure.
And if you just look at like nucleation droplet theory, if you as you go towards the point where you actually become unstable and you nucleate a critical droplet, you'd think that before that you'd see more fluctuations, that more bubbles would try to grow.
Yeah. All kind of in the droplets, funny old droplet models of the critical phenomena.
But if you were looking at a first order transition and looking at.
That's what you see. You see
you see more.
And you just do a mean field approximation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you do that. Doesn't specifically have a finite jump?
And it just sort of finds, comes up to a point and falls off.
Yeah.
And it's smooth behavior after the jump and smooth behavior past.
Yeah, right, but the question is it smooth with an increase?
But not a mean field.
Well, you can have a finite increase in mean field.
It may or may not be, and I think the idea of looking at changing particle size. So your argument would be that if you increase the scale of your system or decrease the size of your particles, that this would move in. Occur in a smaller range or something like that? Is that the thrust of your argument?
Or then you should see maybe a bigger range of increase if you had more particles.
Well, no, smaller range.
Well,
if it's really for a short electron, dominated by a finite size effect, exactly. It has to go away when your system
is bigger. Right, I was saying if it's second order, then if it was critical, then it would you'd see a bigger range.
Right. So I mean, that is a good idea of trying to distinguish between critical and super critical. Okay.
If I try to understand geometrically the causes of the features that we're seeing here,
right.
The distributions that you show, could you go back one slide just for a second? Mm-hmm. The Batman curve, and this is just a check if I'm correct, but the Batman curve suggests to me that you have two peaks because of the distinct orientations of the force vectors, because you have such a highly crystallized system.
No, I don't think so.
It's because he has a sine wave force, and because you're the maximum and minimum force of that sine wave, you spend a lot of time, that you're more likely to be at the big force or the small force. Just take a sine wave and ask how often the sine wave has a given height. And there'll be many more times when it's either the maximum or the minimum than near the center.
So the change is slow.
Is this the sine wave comes about from the vibration?
Yeah, no, it's from the vibration.
From the vibration.
And it's measuring it on the vibrating plate.
And then this is averaging over all of those values.
That's right.
Okay, vibrating. I misunderstood that. Yeah. But maybe this question still, or this statement is still correct, that where you have the transitional condition,
right.
It's the effort of trying to break out of that order that results in high forces in local regions, but a relatively small number. And once it breaks out of that, then you've gone through that dilation phase, basically.
For instance, that's common, that sounds like the same. Okay.
And so the larger the system size, then those would be averaged over more particles. And probably the tail would contract a little bit.
Well, and the question is how, in some sense, you could think of it as a correlation. What you tend to see, for instance, in this fluid arcs region is perlite chunks, which come together. And the size of that chunk, I think, probably grows as you approach the transition from above. And that, so then when you look at the at these volumes, like here, so if you look here, right, which is what is tending to happen, if you get these perlite chunks, which push the system apart. And they're growing as you get closer and closer to this transition point.
There's probably distinct orientations for those too.
Oh, absolutely, of course.
The shear demand.
Yeah. But I mean, there's more than one orientation that will probably form.
So Bob, this is still on the limit where the fluidization is only near the top wall, right? And yet you're measuring the bottom wall. And so the question is, are you just seeing fluctuations in this structure being transmitted through a fairly elastic path, or are you seeing rearrangements all the way to the bottom?
So you see rearrangements all the way to the bottom. And so it is not ordered. It's not like you have a disordered region sitting on top of an ordered region. The disorder is through.
Disorder is all the way down, but the shear is still localized.
But the shear, the actual displacement is localized close to the center.
So if it were a phase transition, especially a first order phase transition, and I think that that would just as likely to see it. The disordered regions being separated from the jammed region is fine.
Yeah, you could have coexistence.
You would expect, well, you have local, in some sense, you have local coexistence. Mm-hmm. So you have little crystallites that float around the system, both of these planar crystalline states and other 3D crystal states, or these planar crystal states.
Which could have the whole bottom crystal.
You could. I mean, that's, of course, if you had a gravitational field, you might feel that would happen. That's not what this is.
You're sure it's not what you see? Because after all, even if it's really pretty jammed and pretty solid, I would expect to see the occasional rearrangements because I've got, it's supporting some sort of stress.
So I
see.
But this might be far from the transition. You might think right near the transition
I see essentially no rearrangements going on now.
Well, it's slow. Just slow.
It's slow.
There's one at the end, which is
slow. But I would guess
that. Not crystallized. That is crystallized. Yeah. This is, and these sort of look like line, crystal lines.
Well, but it will completely transform from this back to that.
That's impressive.
Right.
I think the vibrations are critical to that.
They are. Yeah. That's right. So I mean, it's very easy to produce the orbs.
Vibrations are doing something like adding a temperature.
They are, and they actually give it the system the opportunity to explore a piece of phase space that would never fly around.
It keeps cracking. That's quite interesting too.
Dislocation.
Yeah. Of course, there has to be dislocation in this geometry. Because otherwise,
it's not a crack that stays open, or that. I don't see any rearrangements along that. But just sort of.
No, it opens up and closes right and heals right back up. Yeah. Right. And these are very.
Which tells me too, there's a lot of rigidity.
Well, it is, and of course, also this doesn't fix it. Yeah. Okay. All right. So
interesting. Where are we?
So phase boundary. Okay. So there is a phase boundary. Apparently, between the crystalline and the disordered state, and the phase boundary. So this is again, this is a measure, dimensionless measure of the acceleration, and then this is a measure of the shear rate, and the transition point occurs. Apparently, when the energy input per particle from shaking equals the energy input per particle from shear, that seems to be the transition point.
So that line comes from?
This line just says, in some gross measure, put the energy input per particle from. A omega squared, a squared omega squared equals 1/2 omega squared.
Do you really measure these values, or do you have a calculation where you estimate these values when the omega is less or greater than the gamma?
These are all measured points.
No. But there's the omegas and the gammas. Do you actually measure them, or do you...
The prefactor in this group?
Yes. So the value for the omega and the value for the gamma, do you measure that directly, or do you...
That line is drawn as the point at which omega square is equal to 1/2 e. Something of that sort. I mean,
so you know the amplitude.
These are all quantities that we know.
But then you don't really know how much of the energy the system gives back to the external device. I mean, just having a frequency in this space doesn't really give you an energy input.
No, not specifically, right? So there's some sort of light put in scale factor 1 and scale factor 2, and then your observation is that the ratio of those factors is 1.
The energy induced with shear is not necessarily e omega squared either. That's assuming a viscous type response, which is not necessarily the case. You don't know the shear types, right?
This is just saying put that line on that state and ask how well does it describe. And the answer is it seems to describe it well. So now you can ask why does it describe it well. Okay. But don't tell me,
But I think to call it E omega is misleading.
Potentially misleading.
I'm really confused.
It is potentially misleading. But I mean that's where the line goes, whether you
I understand.
Now okay,
this line we have no problem with.
Right.
Find it. I'm just saying that if you go ahead and you look at what E omega is,
right,
it's not necessarily that. The actual if you really wanted to find the energy in the shear, how would you define it? You take it.
Sure.
You have to have force times displacement rate times the time. And so, the force is not necessarily proportional to the displacement rate.
Sure. And you can imagine creating other parameters which characterize the energy.
And I guess I'm particularly sensitive to this particular issue because if you look at a paper by Shiram Ramaswamy and Ren, they argued that the transition temperature for colloidal shear melting had to go as the square root of the shear rate, okay? Based on an argument that the energy associated with the shear went quadratically in the shear rate, and that the free energies of the photosynthesis phase should be
equal. Okay.
Experimentally, it goes linearly because there's a yield stress.
Okay.
And that's something that came out of our simulations as well. So that the, the energy, in fact, had a constant shift plus a linear term as opposed to being quadratic. And completely, the experimentalist actually, Paul Chaikin, took all this data and kept looking linear, but he knew it had to be quadratic. So he threw the data out and never published it. The simulations.
Understood why.
No, I couldn't find it. The student had moved on and become Dan Liang. He moved on to Liang and become a professor in the computer district. Had been on. It's all gone.
Another question. Presumably, if you increase gamma way out, it's going to melt again.
That's not necessarily because it's in fixed. If it's in positive fixed, you have to get a lot of spin.
You might have to do some different.
So in some sense, this also gets, in the context of what Mark is saying, has to know the applied load. Because that determines the things like the yield stress or the ability of the system to expand and so forth. So it's not a in principle, yes, to your question, but in practice, there's some other things.
And you don't know what. The torque is no way of measuring.
It's not easy to measure the torque. I mean, it's not impossible for us, but we have to put torque in. So for you, Mark, I'm
okay. All right. Well, if you're comparing the energies, what you wrote on the board there, I don't see gamma.
Oh yeah. So you have to put in. So gamma. Can you see it from here? Let me do it on this board.
I think it's 1/2.
Press hard on the chart. It might be easier to see.
He's really got 1/2 velocity squared equals 1/2 velocity squared.
That's right.
In one case, the velocity is the amplitude times the frequency, and the other, the particle diameter times the shear rate.
So
which one's the amplitude times the frequency?
So gamma is.
Hey, Bob.
We turned on the light.
So gamma is A omega squared. But it was a G. And so therefore, if you like, gamma.
Yes.
Okay. So you have to. Intrinsically in that plot is a bit of what A is.
Because we often use, but I've never seen omega used for shear. So I was thinking you were using it for representing some angular velocity.
Well, we have two omegas in this column.
Right.
We have to assign something to each one. if Jean's not looking at them, also look at these sliding terms. Okay, so going back to force. Okay, so these are experiments where you can, this kind of thing, like where you're doing compressional experiments or pure shear, or you can do your gas. And then what we see is the following. So when you shear the system, what you tend to do is you don't change the tangential forces, which are small in any way. So they're 10% of the normal forces that you need. But when you shear your hot rate, the high force part of the distribution function, which doesn't seem unreasonable because what you're doing is you're giving some small set of particles or a small set of contacts a large force to carry the compression load. When you compress the system, then in fact, you're carrying, in some sense, you get something which is more gas. Okay, would be the sense. But you don't need these large load carrying particles, and that pushes in that part of the distribution.
But if you don't have any plastic rearrangement, you just take an elastic material with some disorder,
right,
then you don't get the exponential tail. It's
under compression.
Yeah.
I'll have it under shear.
Well, it's only under shear. It doesn't matter. You just take some sample and you pose the strain. Unless you're actually forcing it to rearrange,
right,
you don't see an exponential tail.
And what do you consider rearrangement? Right. This, you know, this so this is actually what you're doing is you're opening contacts in one direction.
No, in the compression case, because you're just sort of pushing stuff in, and there's no reason why there's massive rearrangement.
Well, there are no massive rearrangements.
Well,
and in either case,
there may be almost no rearrangements in the case of compression.
Yes. Right. Certainly, there are probably no. This is probably the first.
And I'm just saying, if I take a static configuration and I force all the bonds to be elastic or do anything that keeps things from breaking and rearranging the bonding,
okay,
then I will never pick up an exponential tail.
Okay, I will do that.
And so, in the compressed case, you're not forcing that rearrangement, so you can't really expect anything interesting to happen. But in the shear case,
right. Well, so
stuff sort of rearranges at the margin of stability.
But then I would ask whether it matters whether you have attractive forces in the problem as well.
I want to interject a little bit here because what I see here is two points on a broad continuum,
right,
that represents the stress state of the assemblage during shear or deformation.
Absolutely.
And it's not like there's one compressive state or one shear state, as might be implied by this diagram, but that it depends on the magnitude of the stresses, the principal stresses, which is the relative magnitude of the principal stresses that are acting on the system. So in the case of shear, because you have allowed the system to dilate, you also have reduced the compression in the direction perpendicular to the principal force orientation. In compression, you have an isotropic stress state.
You don't allow dilation.
Not under shear. So it's pure shear.
Okay.
But starting from the state of originally zero pressure.
Wait, what's the configuration of this? It's pure shear means that you have coaxial strain and stress?
Yes, so it's squeezing in one pair of directions and then expanding equally.
Okay, well, that is able to dilate and it is maintaining. No, not dilation. I'm sorry, but you're introducing a tensile state. So there's compression in one direction while tension in the other.
There's no tension now.
You have to have a little bit of tension in order to allow.
Well, there's no. You can't have
less compression the other way.
Okay.
It's pure shear.
Okay. Right.
Technically pure shear. So you expect these tails to stay even, for instance, if in the 4% strain guy, you crank up the pressure until Z equals 3.7?
So you want to do uniaxial compression?
Starting from the shear guy, then you compress until you get to the same, either the same pressure or same Z in the other guy.
So I think it's completely, well, if...
So there's data for uniaxial compression. I mean, it's not clear. I think this is not as good data, so we haven't done as much of that.
Here you mean there are no lateral forces.
Right, and I think there's a set. I wouldn't want to bet the ranch on this, right? But this thing actually is stretching out slightly slower than exponential. This is clearly much faster than exponential. And it can go into something like the state where that Craig was saying, where you now have something, I think, approximating uniaxial compression, right? You just squeeze in one direction and don't let it dilate in the other direction. Then you tend not to get a certain
way. Yeah, that shouldn't be called compression because you're allowing the stresses to increase in the lateral dimension. So I mean, well, maybe this is different in the
visually standard literature. You would call it uniaxial compression if you were stress-free in perpendicular.
Right.
Okay.
So we call it uniaxial consolidation because you can deform it without any lateral deformation.
Right. Okay.
Okay. But in this case, then you do have increasing stresses in the lateral direction.
So you do, right? You do have stresses growing in the minor principal stress range.
And what are the different quantities plotted here?
So these are different definitions, not very different. So all of order one.
Oh, it's the magnitude of the deformation? Shortening, for example?
Right. Okay. So the traction will change with that.
And then scaled with the mean force, it shows.
And then scaled by the mean force.
I was very interested in the plots that you showed yesterday where you were doing the correlation function as a function
of
orientation, because I think that would address the issue in the previous plot where you have compression state versus a shear state.
That's right.
If you plot that up as a function of principal stress direction and principal stress ratios, you would probably see a much better correlation among the different regimes that you could do these tests.
So what you're saying is if you divided by the principal stresses,
then
you would see the same behavior in all directions. It doesn't quite work.
You've done that?
Yeah. Okay, so you still, alternatively, right, that would say that the correlation function would look the same in some sense. I mean, it doesn't quite work out.
Okay, I believe that, yeah.
I have a big idea that might address that.
So in terms of Craig's question, at least what I've seen is if I take a state and that's gone to this magic exponential tail state, and now I squeeze on it in some uniform way.
What's exponential?
What? The tail in the distribution is exponential.
Of so that distribution of
forces.
What magnitude forces?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have a sheared state, and once you have the sheared state, the special distribution, then you compress it back to the other.
Yeah, or whatever state, you know, the crazes are another example, right? If you take a state and you add stress to it, and there's no rearrangements going on, then we don't see that, you know, that extra stress is not necessarily going to go into that same exponential tail distribution. It's sort of a more orderly thing. And so it's really crucial that you be somehow rearranging things.
I see that maybe in your picture, but I mean, let me run back.
In this uniaxial compression, were the strains big enough to see rearrangements?
There's very tiny bits of rearrangement.
In the uniaxial compression.
Oh, in uniaxial compression.
In the pure compression, there's no particular reason
why things would need to change. Right.
But in uniaxial, I don't think there is.
Well, let me pull out the case of this pure shear. So I squeezed it and dilated it, and it seems to me the key thing here is not that you're breaking, and not that you're rearranging, but that you have different kinds of contacts. And you have these strong contacts here, which show up in the tail, right? And then, if you like, you have weak contacts in the other direction, which tend to bolster the
low force. I agree with that completely, because you can see this type of arrangement develop with very, very small strains.
And exactly. So this, you can't. I can give you one of these pictures.
What do you call small?
No rearrangements. Just you might see a very slight rotation of the particles. So they're not moving past each other.
Right.
They're just simply now rotating in order to maintain.
That's basically the state. You're not doing major rearrangements.
You're not seeing any.
It could essentially be an elastic.
It is too strong, but there's very small deformation, irreversible deformation going on in the system. You can push it further. So if you push this.
So what percentage strains?
It could be reversible. I mean, it doesn't have to be irreversible. It could be reversible.
You guys have friction, which is the one thing that could make it different. But
that's a bit of a pop out. Until you can show that's the case.
But certainly, if you take. Certainly, this structure is also correlated to the observation. But I just, in the simulations, I haven't seen this kind of structure develop
okay.
without some rearrangements of particles.
So you do see such a structure develop under said pressure.
You can see such structures develop.
Uh-huh. But see, I would argue one big difference is that in some sense, maybe it's not a big deal, but I mean, your system stays connected. Right? I mean, when you pull the system apart, your system is still connected. You can have tension in your system. I can't. Okay. So I can imagine pushing this. And really, yeah, the particles open up, and that's just as irreversible, I think. I mean, just so you totally destroy content, but you can restore it mm-hmm. by going backwards. So it's reversible, and I don't see an analog in your system.
It was the cracks that we saw forming during the simulation here. Yeah. You see things cracking open and then shutting again without changing.
And this is how it reveals.
Yeah, it turns out the adhesive parts don't do as interesting things as you don't get exponentials on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
your forces aren't symmetric that way either. Of course. Okay. So I mean, it's not clear to me whether it's just a friction versus whether you have an attractive part of your force.
Well, what I would say is you have, in addition to having plastic rearrangements, which I think can lead to this, you have the opportunity for the local friction forces to go past some threshold, right?
They can slip, right?
And so that type of rearrangements also allows the force.
There's a curve, but there's very, very few observable slips. You know, for a few percent deformation, you know, if you say, I'm going to do 10% deformation, you know, start to see slips.
Okay, so typically for us, every particle has had plastic rearrangements by 5%.
Okay, so I mean, I think what's probably happening here is it would not have, there's a friction to stabilize in this plastic tension precedent. I mean, we don't see plastic in this.
I think when we do shear experiments, which generally go up to, say, 200% strain or more, then, of course, there's this initial stage where the particles are deforming elastically without undergoing significant reorganization, and that's while the strength is increasing. And then we reach a peak strength, and from that point on, we essentially shear the entire assemblage.
Right, and so the question is, if you're looking, going up, first of all, what strain does that peak correspond to? You get these chains?
It's usually on the order of, I would say, between 5 and 10%.
That's what you see for the mistakes.
Yeah, and then beyond that,
less than 5%, you would see this structure.
True. Uh-huh.
Well, absolutely. See, I mean, you know, 1%, 0.5%.
In our case, we don't have a crystallized structure, and so consequently, particles are reorganizing quite early in the.
We see reorganizations all the way down to the.
This is not crystallized. So this is called spurious. So it does have some order, but it's it's not strong order.
It's fascinating. You can see some of that order looking at this at the bottom of your.
Right. I mean, there clearly is some order, perhaps, but it's not intended as a unified crystal system.
So are you going to show us quickly this PDF from the other group?
Could I insert one comment about the figure you showed before? You don't have to bring it back up. But the observation that the degree of shortening, E, did not affect the distribution function significantly is consistent with a concept that we have in soil mechanics or sediment mechanics, that in a uniaxial consolidation state, the horizontal stress correlates with the vertical stress. Mm-hmm. And so one would expect that if you could normalize that by the mean stress, you would have the same kind of distribution. So your experiments seem to be consistent with that.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's carried over to the Janssen thing. Okay. This is transmission coefficients you apply. But, you know, in a silo, when people apply a load, then there's this uniform transmission of stresses to the socket, which depends only on the postal normal load.
So, this assumes non-adhesive grains.
It could also be adhesive. It's really, it's a large-scale phenomenon. It's an experimental phenomenon. Because we don't unload it. Pre-unloading is different.
Does everybody know this paper? Or maybe I can show everyone this. Okay. So the basic experiment is a big cylindrical container of particles. And then what they have is, so here are all the particles. They put a wheel on top, and then they rotate the thing. Okay. And then they're looking at the bottom of this thing through a photoelastic sheet. Okay. So in some sense, it's the same scale as the 3D experiments I was showing you. So it's this size. And now what they see is that at the base here, in close in to the center, things don't slip. Okay. And then as you move out, they start to slip. Okay.
And the passing number bottom, if I remember, is pretty crystalline.
Right. I would still expect it would be highly crystalline because these are about 100% copper versus the particles. So I would think they're probably pretty. And now, so what they see is these are pretty different.
You put the right hand side and pull this up to the zero.
What is it?
And just to close the right
hand side. Get rid of that right hand side, this is a high.
Ah.
And now do the plus. Now.
So now they're doing this for different depths, right? And now the trick is, so if you look at their fairly deep pot.
So they illuminate with some sheet.
They have this, right? Okay, so then you look at their photoelastic sheet and you see different illuminations, and then somehow they convert that into a force. Okay, so, and in ways which I don't totally understand. But, and then presumably there's no way for them to distinguish between whether it's a normal force or a shear force, and if they take it all, it's basically normal forces. Okay, now, so the peculiar thing is that when let's see if I get this right. Okay. So, so I don't play your mind.
The different colors are just different depths?
They're at different distances, radial distances from the center.
Oh. Okay. Oh.
All right. So depending on whether you're in the sort of compressive region where everything is presumably just mushed down, or you're in a region where there's shear, they see a different distribution. Okay. And so then what they claim is that, I don't know if people have seen an earlier paper by this group where basically they made a kind of thermodynamic argument that what you're looking at in the P1s is something akin to what you look at if you looked at G of R. Okay, so G of R is just some measure of, so you're looking at some average of E to the minus beta times the potential. And so then the argument goes that this is just representative of the force bond that you have between the particles. Right? And I remember seeing this paper back, and this is like 5 years ago. Okay. And so then the claim is that they can understand these as just different manifestations of the same probability distribution function, but in some sense just by scaling, say, with the appropriate value of the mean force. And again, that's the use. Okay. All right. So S is the distance from the center of the shear of the system. Okay. And so close to the center is the blue. So this is like the squeezing down, which is, of course, they claim is an equivalent to their what they see in static compressive experiments, right? So back in 10 years ago or something like that, when they first looked at P of S, what this group did was they filled a container with spheres with a layer of carbon paper underneath, and they pushed down to the bottom. And so then what they claim to see then in that regime, which is sort of more like just a compressive regime, is then they see this thing that is just an exponential distribution of forces. Okay. And then as they move out into the regime which is shearing, okay, the most extreme example is the relative distribution. Okay. So in some sense, the thing I don't understand is it seems to me to be the reverse of what we see. Okay. So if you think of these as measuring the normal forces, then when we're in a regime which is characterized by strong shear, we see something which is basically exponential. And when we're in a regime which is more or less isotropic compression, we see something that's more gassy.
But they do. But they take the measurements sort of in situ while the thing is shearing. Right? They don't. They don't let the thing come back to rest. And
no. So the idea. That's right. So they take, I don't know, 10,000 frames over some period of time.
Aren't they measuring a plane perpendicular to the Earth?
Well,
yes.
Yeah. No. Mine doesn't have perpendicular. Mine is vector forces.
Correct, but their forces that would be analogous to yours would be those radially oriented. And here, if I'm correct, they're measuring from the base, right?
Well, I mean, one plane is. So they're looking at the right. So they're taking a cut.
So it's like this. It's spinning this way.
That's right.
And they're measuring this way. Like
they're measuring forces
that are oriented vertically. That's even though in your geometry you have forces that are varying around in a two-dimensional sense. I mean,
there's the velocity,
right?
Presumably
the directional shear, right?
Tangential rather. Uh-huh. Gradients is presumably radial,
right.
And they're measuring in the third direction, normal to both of those, which is not something you have any information about.
Right. Well, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. And so it's not obvious
how to compare them.
So it seems that, I mean, in a way, this is a response to the normal. The normal load is what they're measuring, and the normal load is varying in response to the radius.
To the shear.
That's right.
So you could say somehow that since this direction is not really involved with the motion, the scrambling of things due to shear is sort of eliminating the frustration of this degree of freedom and removing really high forces.
But then there's shear in both directions.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not just shear, right? I mean, as you go radially outward, the shear.
I like how you said
shear is a function of height.
Sure.
And do you have any that which is bigger, the shear is a function of height, or the shear is a function of height?
I have no idea. I don't say no either, because they can't. You know, I look at the bottom. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't looked at this paper, but I'm confused about what they're doing here. Do they have like a turntable that they're pushing down from the top, or do they have something from the side?
It's a turntable, and they're pushing down.
But Julia, it's something that you could easily. Well, I guess you do normally 2D, but you have something.
Oh, but it can be done in 3D.
Yeah,
so the question is how much of that disruption propagates in the normal direction. The frustration, as you say.
Yeah.
It's a neat concept that, in fact, it strengthens the system in the normal direction. And since it doesn't have to, I think the way you described it, and I'll put it in my words and then we can somehow fight through this, but as the shearing is taking place, there's two-dimensional, there's contacts that are occurring that are basically supporting the load in the lateral direction, and that is reducing the load in the vertical direction. Or the stress.
The fluctuations.
The yeah. fluctuations.
Well, and we don't know the minimum, right? So I don't, at least, yeah, these are just Fs. So these are not normalized by means.
But,
so when you're shearing the lowness, as you say, the mean, and as well as the fluctuation.
One thing that we've made an effort to do in our models is to normalize by a constant mean force at different points within the experiment.
By the local mean.
Yeah, because the forces are varying through time as
sure.
we undergo.
Well, in space, right? Well, that's something which is.
Yeah, but perfect. Say if we're going to do some kind of averaging across that domain.
Right. Well, I mean, these do represent the distribution over time, right? In that sense. So, but hopefully, I mean, at any given ring, it's statistically.
Time is running out as well.
Yes. Okay. Who's got
Nothing that I show, nothing that I have really needs to be shown. But one comment I'd like to make, though, is that because I like to think in stress space, the forces. This is very eye-opening for me to see how the forces have been studied before. But we actually sum the forces to determine the stress field in a domain.
Right.
And so, I was just going to quickly show how that is done, but it's not that difficult.
To compute the Cauchy stress.
Yeah, to compute the stress.
We've done some.
And then we've also done a little bit of work on the orientation distribution of the forces. The normal forces, regardless of whether you factor in the shear forces, because like you say, it's a very small component, the force distribution is very clearly correlated with the stress field, as one would expect. So the reason I was jumping in there to comment on the fact that the compression and the shear experiments that you show are just two points on a continuum of possibilities of stress.
Right, stress distributions. And that's absolutely true.
And there's going to be a very strong correlation with the force distribution. I think that's something that hasn't been quantified very well. We have data points, like for a particular stress field, like you're showing here. But I love the concept that you posed yesterday, that in compression, when you do the orientation distribution, of course everything lies on a common line, but as the stress becomes more and more not anisotropic, those two diverge. And what's the extreme? At what point do the force distributions, when you don't have adhesion, when you don't have bonding, at what point where you simply now, you have taken away all of the stress that's acting in the perpendicular direction of principal stress, then you wouldn't see any forces at all. So there, that whole gradient would be very interesting.
You can't quite get there because it will massively fail.
Yeah.
By the time you get close to that.
Right.
I'd love to see what you do.
But if it's just showing how you sum up the forces.
No, I have the animation to that.
The animations would be. I think the summing of forces to get local stresses and that balance is probably something people.
Yeah, that's
something let's see because we do that in MD.
Right, I mean, that's.
But I do have some animations that I don't think I showed before. So yeah, that could be.
The animations.
And some I have shown, so we can do that. But we used this force, this stress calculation, and then we calculated the average stress on a particle.
Yeah, I think it will.
Will it bring it up?
I think.
There's a dot at the front of it, that's what it doesn't like.
Oh, I see.
Could that be like your...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, that isn't big.
Because it's a period.
Right,
but I wonder if...
What?
I think it was just a period in the warning message.
No, it's
a period.
Yeah,
that
one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let me just find an interesting image. So this is taking that approach of calculating the average stress on the particles in the Sherman assemblage, and then plotting up, in this case, the mean stress on the particle, because there's mean and a differential component. So if you plot the differential component, you can plot the mean stress. So it's essentially...
So this is the difference in principal stresses?
No, in this case, it's the sum of the principal stresses, or the average principal stress, I should say. And then we color code those, and the color indicates that, so as the color becomes hotter, the mean stress increases, and we do recognize these very distinct force chains. So it's very similar to what you were showing with the photoelastic disks, and this gave you this
outcome. What are the bars? Are they rotations?
And the bars represent principal stress direction for a local region. And so in fact, that's very nice. It correlates quite well with most of the stress orientations. And then just to give you a sense of geometry here, I have walls that are rough, and those are shearing in this direction. So I have right lateral shear strain, and this will evolve with time. And I've just taken a couple of snapshots here. So we're going to look at 160 or 166% shear strain. And this is the stress strain diagram starting at 100. So you're not seeing the initial stages. It's just starting at 100, going to 200. You can see that. Then over here are actually the particle forces plotted from center to center. Just the normal force, because the shear force can be quite high and it results in a rotation, creates a lot of confusion in interpreting it. And then in the back, and so they scale, the increase in width indicates an increase in the particle force. And then behind that is the gradient in the horizontal displacement over the last 2% shear strain. This is essentially the incremental shear structure, one could say. It's where slip is occurring. And red indicates that there's a band on which slip is occurring. And so you'll see this evolve over these 8% shear strain. But one of the interesting things to watch is how the colors in the particles over here change as we enter the shear. So we'll just go through a couple of these. You can see that the strain continues to be localized in this general area, but becomes a little more diffuse. And we now have quite a few red particles indicating strong force chains. And in the next increment of strain, we're going to lose quite a few of those as we went from slip in this position to slip in this position. So this was accommodated by breakage of these force chains, and where the breakage was most intense or most rapid is where you get a localization forming. And we can follow that in a number of different ways, like this, or by looking at particle rotations in a given increment.
Do you understand that all the chains seem to be more horizontal than 45 degrees? Do you understand why?
Well, they tend to actually span around 45 degrees. So this is something to...
Maybe I'm wrong, but to my eye, it seems like they're all sort of, you know, less than 45, more horizontal than 45.
Is it an aspect ratio issue?
Could be. In some of these simulations, I have turned off rolling, which would make it stronger. This is not one of those. So these particles are able to roll.
Okay.
But I do see this band like that. But then elsewhere, these bands that seem to be a little bit smaller. So my sense is when we average these up, they tend to fluctuate around 45 degrees. But that's just one example. This is, obviously, continuing 168. This is a slightly different experiment, a higher velocity. And the increase in the velocity creates a difference in the stress strain diagram as well. Previously, let me just back up a second so you can see. Very nice stick slip like responses where you have an elastic loading phase and then a precursory slip undergoes some local plastic deformation and then a sudden stress drop. And as you increase the sliding velocity of the walls, you get a more oscillating mode of deformation. That's something that Collins group had also shown. But still, the same type of phenomenon occurs in the force chain development and dissipation. Here's a really low angle one of the ones that you observed before. when you have higher velocities, deformation tends to be more distributed throughout. These are, they're spheres, but they lie in a plane, fixed common plane, and there are no other spheres interacting with them, but we're using Hertzian contact law to calculate the forces at the contacts for spheres.
Is it clear when you say high velocity? The question is what the scale velocity is. Now,
it's actually millimeters per second.
Okay, but in terms of some, in terms of what we've seen at least in some of the velocity simulations, if you're going fast enough that stress can't equilibrate across the sample after some rearrangement has occurred, then you're more likely to see, you know, slip in many different locations like this, and any large steps in the force tend to get averaged out because you have different processes adding in coherently throughout the depth of the sample.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about what the effective sound velocity or stress equilibration time is for these systems?
We actually choose very small time steps with the intention that perturbations will have a chance to propagate across.
Well, the time step is irrelevant. That's just your integration time. The question is what's your velocity?
Velocity is relative to the sound velocity. It's very, very small.
But it's not, again, it's not the sound velocity of the particle, it's the sound velocity across the assembly.
So is the sound velocity the relevant velocity? She has this frictional contact between the disks. That means the stress perhaps equilibrates much more slowly than in a molecular simulation.
Even in the molecular simulation, you see some very slow dynamics associated with rearrangements.
Well, I haven't calculated the sound velocity for this particular assemblage. But just to throw out some numbers, we're using values of density and stiffness that are analogous for quartz beads or sand. And for an assemblage with this density, the geologic system, even non-cohesive geologic system, the velocity would be on the order of kilometers per second. And here I'm sharing this at a rate of millimeters per second. So I'm not too concerned about that contrast. Is that?
Well,
is this sort of what you're thinking?
I mean, you're saying you're at a level of consolidation such that all the contacts are in an elastic. I mean, see, the fact that you have these, you know, it's an inhomogeneous medium. It can also have multiple sound modes.
It definitely will.
And there's a very fast acoustic mode, right, which may be the kilometer per second that you're talking about.
Compressional.
And that's the one that typically would be remain undamped in the long wavelength limit. There also can be other modes. You've got some damping, so you can have diffusive propagation of stress equilibration, and all sorts of other much slower shear time scales.
Those are the things that are probably affecting this
model. Right. Well, and so that. Those are stress equilibration depends on all of those, and so it's the stress equilibration time would not necessarily be the one related to your kilometer.
Usually, I mean, wouldn't you then expect if you were starting to move at slightest speed, such that you were exceeding the wave propagation time, wouldn't you expect like a qualitative change in the kinds of behavior you'd see in the sample, like distributing stress relaxing sort of uniformly across the entire system, whereas here it seems like just a quantitative shift in how wide the region that's slipping at any given time is.
Well, you see multiple regions.
Regions.
So what you could say is there's a correlation length which is set by the propagation velocity and the shear rate, right? That gives me.
But you're looking at this in same regions as opposed to one thicker region? Is that?
Yeah, if you look at it.
It's periodic band, so that's one
Yeah, these are periodic and lateral.
One connected thing.
Could you show the movie?
That's a good point.
Look at the movie and see.
So this to back up on this one, or do I look at some others?
Yeah, let's just look at this one.
Okay, let me take it back. So
it looks like a thick.
Comes in.
You just think it's a thick region.
A thicker. Yeah.
See, there's that little
thing that happens down there, but.
I think these may be animated. These are.
See, look at that.
Okay. These are even higher velocity. And what's plotted here, and Bob hasn't seen these, you can see the higher velocity of the results, you can see the more distributed deformation. What's plotted here are basically the gray bars that we saw on the right-hand side are now color-coded, but still increasing thickness as a function of the interparticle force. And we're using exactly the same colors in this diagram. We have very small particles in this system, but now we have larger particles, it's a lot easier to see the force chains develop and diffuse. One thing to point out is that at the 0% strain, we have consolidated this package this way, so we have a principal direction of force chains that's subvertical. But now you can look at this, what did I say? This is a 10% strain, so between 5 to 10% strain is what it takes to get to a relatively stable strength. And within that time period, you can see the plane inclination of these force chains and increase in magnitude because we're not changing the normal stress. So in order for the shear stress to be added to this, it increases the total.
But if you actually look at the probability distribution of the force during that period.
Yeah, I haven't done that. That's okay. What I'm keeping in view. This evolution stage is quite interesting. And also the jumps with the high and low, high to low.
So see, now you see a much more constant friction force, and I think there's basically a coherent. Well, but I think as long as you are going slow enough, and that will depend upon how big your system is or how many particles you have. As long as you're going slow enough, that the entire system is stress equilibrated, that you will get localization on one primary. But if you start going faster, then you know at some point each region just feels the average stress and does its own shearing and its own instability, independent of all the others, and then you get this smoothing out. And in the molecular realm, there's some evidence that happens. So.
So do you think of that as a physical phenomenon or a numerical artifact?
Well, I think the issue is that one wants to know what I think it's a real effect that's set by a scale velocity, and the question is, what is the scale velocity? I think it's related to stress equilibration, which I think is much slower than the naive estimates that you would have from acoustic sound velocities. I think it's interesting to know what that stress equilibration velocity is, whether it's a velocity, whether it's diffusive, you know. And in the amp system, it may be diffusive at large light scales.
So I mean, how much is known about these slow relaxation modes in electrical systems?
Very little, as far as I know.
So not something, because I mean, we also see these, so the conduit tubes within them, I interact. The simulations of a similar flavor, except that this system are discs, disc like rather than. Mm-hmm. And there's very clearly a slow mode in the systems, but it's not clear how to.
Right. So if you take a crystal, it's pretty clear that it's the sound velocity, right? When you take an ideal fluid, it's pretty clear. But in some sort of glassy, amorphous solid with a lot of low frequencies, it's not so obvious. We just see really slow stuff, and I can see, but I don't know what. But here, one in principle could try to superimpose stress on the system and watch its relaxation.
That's what we're
taking. Take a simulation, take a state, and then just impose some vertical stress increment on it and see how.
Yeah, or just, you know, make a small increase in the sliding velocity of the wall, or any number of things, and watch the.
But when you say watch, you want to know what's happening across the domain. Right?
You want to watch it moving from one side to the other. Yeah.
And in this case, we have anti-symmetric shear, so we're moving there for a while, same rate in opposite directions.
So you could just put a little dilational bump on one side. You could put a small increase on one of the two walls and not the other. And
right, yeah. It would be quite useful to do, I'm sure.
So basically, the bottom line is more likely people see it, but don't understand.
I don't know how many people have even seen it.
Look directly for stress relaxation. No, I know there. We see slow relaxations at stresses below the yield stress. I mean, we've looked at our anelastic and looked at the time scale, holding its rising stress and holding its stresses below the yield stress.
And that's not creep, right?
No,
because at zero temperature or
at very low temperature.
Well, you also have, you know, just regular elasticity, since, like you were saying, the glass, there are all these low modes lying around, and these low modes participate in the elasticity, too.
Right. So there was some evidence with York that we were seeing times about two orders of magnitude lower than expected for stress equilibration without actual rearrangements. But
that would also, those kinds of times would also show up in just the sound speed too, I would think.
Well,
I mean, the kinds that I was just talking about, just having low line modes and the spectrum dividing modes, that piece should show up.
Well, but the point is that you might then have multiple sound. I mean, the sound. There's the sound speed, and then there's other types of modes. There's a lot of, like if you take a fluid filled rock, there are many different sound speeds that are measured. You know, there's acoustic propagation just through the rock, there's acoustic propagation through the fluid, that you can get mixed modes that can be much slower due to the tortuosity of the pore space. So, it is related somehow to these low-frequency modes, but the question is, are there any of those low-frequency modes with long wave length as well?
So let me pose a slightly different question, which may connect with the modes that you're calling around. How sensitive is the observation of, say, these slow times or not to boundary conditions that you apply, say, fixed volume versus one reason why I ask that is that this group may or not know about the work by Olivia Hudekamp, where so these are granular avalanche flows with a free surface in the vertical motion. And basically, you can take lots of different measures. So he's been studying the system for a lot of years. And you can take almost any measure he wants, and claims that then you can express it simply on the terms of a shear rate times a particle number scaled by the acoustic speed. So there's a unique time scale in this system set by the acoustic speed and the
particle scale.
Right. So particle number divided by the acoustic speed.
Well, the acoustic speed would be the
square root of p over.
This is a generation of the
component. So there's lots of different things, but I can point to some of that stuff.
This is an important discussion. That's the question.
Shall we continue?
Yeah.
Sure.